Hi, this is Dr. E.
And this is Dr. Dre.
Welcome to our podcast,
Mixtape Hope. How does music work? Join us as we share a conversation and a music lesson from Connor McCready. He eloquently references David Byrne's book and so much more regarding the why and the science of music. To say that Connor is an intellect, creative, artist, and more would be an understatement. As a multi-instrumentalist and record producer, he brings a unique blend of genres to anyone fortunate enough to catch him around town and abroad on the music scene. He navigates his musical career much like the roadways which bring him back and forth from his hometown in Cleveland, Ohio, to the byways and stages of New Orleans.
His energy and passion for music is electric and infectious. His knowledge and desire to teach reminds us that we should always be present to learn. One of humanity's greatest gifts, music, tethers us together. Only the truly gifted can inspire us to hear, to see, absorb, learn, and then want to perform. A true professor in his own, we thank Connor for being one of those rare souls. All right. Well, welcome to Mixtape Hope. Today we'd like to introduce
Mr. Connor McCready.
Hello.
Yes.
Welcome
thank you
in studio.
So much.
Another guest that we get to actually have here in place. So thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And full disclosure, this has been in my heart on the books for a while because I am a student of Connor's and he is just a wealth of information. Besides giving good homework, he is a wealth of information. I want to kind of see if he could share with us some of his journey and what he's up to right now. So we're going to go ahead and let you introduce yourself. Where are you from?
Yep.
How long have you been here?
My name is Connor McCready, local musician. I'm originally from Cleveland, Ohio. My family, kind of the story of how I ended up here, is half of my family, my mother's side, is all from New Orleans. So a few generations back, I mean, you know, great-great-grandparents from southern Louisiana. So I always had family here, coming to visit my grandma, loved it here, got to see a really cool side of New Orleans. Mm-hmm. I guess a big thing in the Midwest is when people leave, people grow tired of Cleveland. I never did. It's still my favorite city in the world, but
nice.
A lot of people grow tired of it. They move to New York, Chicago, you know, closer to the bigger cities, but something about those cities didn't really quite feel right to me and always come to New Orleans. I remember there's one summer I was in high school and I went to New York City. My cousin was living there and everyone was so unfriendly. I mean, I love New York for what it is, you know? Right. And then I came here and strangers were talking to me and I was like, what do they want from me? But it was nothing, you know, everyone's just so nice. Aww. Then it was my family kind of showed me the cool side of New Orleans, all the culture here and stuff. And then when I realized I'm going to, you know, play music professionally, this is maybe arguably one of the few places you can still do it in the country. So for a lot of reasons, yeah, wow. That's kind of how I ended up here.
So absolutely. What suburb? So you said Cleveland?
Yes.
Ohio? So Rocky River? Is that the first
so right next to Rocky River, Lakewood, Ohio.
How do you know that?
Okay.
Yeah.
So I have to say, yeah. So Dave Harris, if you're out there listening, he's living in Denver now. So when I grew up in Tampa, he was my neighbor, one of my best friends.
Okay.
Growing up,
was from Rocky River?
Rocky River. So I spent two summers visiting him, staying with him and his sister up there in Rocky River. So we went to the Demon Drop over at Cedar Point.
Yeah.
And took in my first Major League Baseball game, Indians.
What year was it?
In Seattle. That was 1987.
Okay, that was probably all right.
Yeah, so they were doing well.
Yeah, they were doing good back
Chief
then.
Chief Wahoo
yeah.
was in full force. So, I guess he's been retired since.
Retired.
But no, a lot of fond memories of the whole area. So very cool.
I'm from Lakewood, Ohio, which is in between Cleveland proper and Rocky Rivers, literally like the town in between the two of them.
You
yeah.
know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
First place I ever saw fireflies and
really
nice deep green grass. Yeah. Yeah. Deep.
He's very a connoisseur
nice
of grass, by the way.
So anyway, yeah, I digress.
Yeah.
So yeah, so here you are. So when did you decide to make New Orleans home?
So I think it was about 2016 or so. I'm 29 now. So I moved when I was 23. Or so. And it was kind of a time where I was almost done going to college and had bounded off studying music, playing music, kind of thinking about it professionally mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And decided, you know, not a lot of my friends were moving or they're kind of hesitant because a lot of people do love Cleveland. It's one of those towns where people just they're just going to live there the rest of their lives. And I think that's a beautiful thing. But I wanted to go, you know, experience other things. And it just seemed like the right place to do it. And, you know, I think for a lot of reasons, New Orleans was the right choice to kind of do the live music.
Nice.
Stuff. Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit, I guess?
Or well, Joe, I know I just I had another thought. Since you're sharing your thoughts, like that's where we saw the Rock and Roll
Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame.
That's right.
Right? I remember like being just so impressed, like questioning, like, why Cleveland? But
I can tell you the history of that.
Yes,
it's a disclaimer. Unfortunately, it's not a positive Cleveland thing, but I think it's by fluke. So actually, when I finished going to college down here, I tried to take as many New Orleans specific classes as I could. Mm-hmm. One of them was the history of New Orleans music, which was really fun. It was like totally my thing. It was really, really cool. I don't know who's teaching the class. I was over at UNO. I don't know who teaches it anymore, but I had learned in that class, our teacher had a little like biased against Cleveland, and apparently it was the home of the Rock Hall because of Alan Freed, the disc jockey who coined the term, was born in Cleveland. I don't know if that's where he kind of came to fame, but it's his resting places in Cleveland too. But it was like a random drawing between a bunch of cities, and I think Cleveland won. So it just ended up, because of him, this like little connection ended up being the home of the Rock Hall. I don't think there's as much deep cultural rock history there, but there's some. There's a little bit.
There's some.
Yeah, that's a nice museum.
Very well done. I love it. Yeah. I loved it.
Right next to the stadium.
That's a cool area. I've got to play at the Rock Hall a few times. It's really cool.
Really?
It's, you know, in that pyramid, and there's like a giant stage in there. It's really cool.
Oh, we got to go back. No, we got to go back. Yeah. Yeah. So, so you recently, like I'm always kind of taking mental notes here, but, recently, and Luis can tell you this, like there's, in the course of everything that we have on our plates, there's very few things that I kind of stick with, right? Or any of us kind of stick with. But I do look forward to our sessions, yes, because of what you teach as far as, you know, the music and the theory, but it's the excitement that you have about what you do and what you live and what, and your passion for music. And so I came home and shared with Luis a book, and lo and behold, he actually read it, and you have it here, a copy of it.
Yeah. I heard that it was the, the topic of discussion.
Yeah. And so he shared so many like fun facts out of it. I was like, really? I still, full disclosure, I have not read it, but what are some of the things?
So the book is
Burns, go ahead.
How Music Works. And when she brought it home, she said, look, it came highly recommended by Connor, my bass instructor, and he's very knowledgeable, and I think she might enjoy it. So I actually listened to the audio version and got so many pearls, but it's
Did he
very
do
dense.
The audio?
He did.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. So you got to hear him say it, too.
And those are the books that
and
I
his
truly
weird,
enjoy.
Neurotic voice.
Yes.
Yeah.
I do believe he was. I'm pretty sure he did it. Yes, it is technically amazing, like his brain, the way it works and the way he kind of broke down at least his style of music writing and performing, and his style, which was unconventional by many means, mm-hmm. when he, you know, decided to go against what basically he put out the music that he wanted to do and collaborate with artists that he wanted to work with and still make it successful, mm-hmm. and worldwide, right? So what are your favorite
sure so points? I guess at large, David Byrne, you know, he's always been one of my favorite musicians, personal hero. I think what kind of struck me about him when I was younger is I was really attracted to, and he even describes this in the book about his approach to appearance and presentation in their music, is that he thought it's more, especially at the time coming from like the punk rock scene and CBGBs, mm-hmm. that it would be more jarring to dress normal. Mm-hmm. And I still, to this day, I think my favorite, like the coolest rock stars to me were Elvis Costello. I remember the first time I saw a picture of him, I was like, why does this dude look like Buddy Holly? His name's Elvis. It's kind of weird. You know, it didn't look like, you know, the Ramones and stuff. They got all this attitude.
That's right.
For some reason, that didn't really strike me, but something about the Talking Heads, they dressed in polos and absolutely, they look like they walked in, you know, from a college dorm or something. They don't look like rock stars at all. And something about that did stand out to me. And I think, you know, something about that, I think there's really like a deeper level to it. And he actually talks about how it was a specific artistic choice to, he thought that was a little more punk rock than dressing up, you know, like the Sex Pistols or the Ramones and stuff. He said that stuff was kind of funny. And this is actually, you know, that all becomes white noise and that this would be a little bit more jarring. So I always, you know, stuff like that, he always struck me by. So I always kind of realized that he had a deeper level, you know, not only did he make weird music, but there was something else going on with him. So cool. And then when someone recommended me this book, I kind of understood how deeply he thinks about art. And, you know, we were going to kind of talk about the combination of science and art and music, in that that is really how his brain works, is that not only is he thinking on that weird creative level, but, you know, on a deep analytical and scientific level too. So I think seeing that written out is like, oh yeah, this is why I like this guy.
Sure. And that's one of the things when Dre comes back from her bass lessons, every time it's like, oh, I just connected another dot, or starting to play pentatonics, or thinking about what sounds right in different measures and beats and different songs that you can apply it to and that you recommend. It's been pretty impressive to see how she's grown.
Well, I mean, that obviously, like, it's just, I feel like you mentioned this one time that, like, we all have this, well, I'm just going to let you expand on it, but the history of just humans in general and how we're in tune to certain sounds. Like you talk a lot about, like, even like the call and answer, like the conversation that a song is having, that the melody is having with something innate within us. Like, I just feel that that's just, it knows no boundaries. It knows no cultures. It just is, like,
which is great. 'Cause, you know, he talks about it. He kind of goes the line between, he's this artist that's known for kind of doing the avant-garde, but also his whole thing is the thesis. Artie just starts out with, you know, actually, should I just read the first sentence of the book?
Yes, absolutely.
I think this is the best thing, is that the first sentence of the book is, I had an extremely slow dawning insight about creation. That insight is that context largely determines what is written, painted, sculpted, sung, or performed. It doesn't sound like much of an insight, but it's actually the opposite of conventional wisdom, which maintains that creation emerges out of some interior emotion, for an upwelling of passion or feeling, and that creative urge will brook no accommodation, that it simply must find an outlet or be heard, read, or seen. So I think the idea is that, you know, he kind of is talking about, people have this idea that artists tap into the unknown, and his thesis already is saying, to be a little jarring, the opposite. He's like, no, it actually comes from, you know, it's a very forced thing. It has to do with science. It has to do with context. That's his big thing, is context.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Has to do with our society, has to do with environment, has to do with all these things. And he kind of explores, because he's so much known on the tapping into something greater thing. I think it's both. And he's describing the other side of it, where he's saying, you know, we have this idea of our head of a classical composer who sits there for hours, then an idea sparks, right? And it's like, they're tapping into something.
Right.
And music and art is that, but it's also just this, like, working, very methodical thing based on context, is what he's saying, which in his book he describes as, like, you know, architecture and history and societal norms and everything that around us that's shaping all of the art that we do too.
Right.
So essentially there's no outsider art. There's no art that's completely, you know, its own thing. Everything is influenced by history, by time, by all of this other stuff. And I just thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
I think the two, and he does this too, the two can be side by side, that you can still, there's still things we don't know about music. That's what's beautiful. He talks about all
that's
these,
so cool,
you know, music theorists and people who've talked about, you know, what is the purpose of music and art and stuff. Nobody really knows. That's the funny thing with science. It's like, here's all these, you know, here's the scientific reasoning behind a lot of the stuff, but then, you know, combining the two, I think, is what he loves and finds so interesting.
He traveled the world, South America, Africa, to try to find all these sounds and incorporate it into something that he could produce and put on.
Do you think there's a purpose of music? I mean, I know we all do.
I don't know. That's the fascinating thing. That's why it's like, I feel like the more I understand, or, you know, read people's scientific perception of it, it makes it even more confusing because it's just putting more theories out there. It's like, oh, it was, you know, it's which I've heard this before from some audio theorists, that music is just, well, in the last chapter of this, it's a music theorist describes music as audio cheesecake. And the whole idea is that, you know, we evolved to have sound, to have certain perceptions of our environment, and, you know, watch out for predators, this and that, understand if we're in a safe place, if we're in a big place. And that music is just, you know, releasing, like, dopamine, serotonin, whatever. And that he's describing it as, like, what cheesecake is. It's like how we react to food, and we found the fattiest version of it, and we just consume it because it's very nice to us. So it's interesting because, you know, then there's, like, that. I've actually heard that music is actually against an evolutionary thing, which is so funny. So it's like, who knows what it is?
Right.
And I think the more we read about that, it's like people don't really know why we're doing this thing.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre. Like I'll deviate for a second. Like you can, and how it's intertwined in other versions of art. Like we're watching this, we don't watch it often, TV shows, but we're watching this special, this Netflix special right now. And there was a scene that I think has slowly become one of my new favorite scenes in a show where it's, should I say the name of Station 11?
Sure.
Yeah, Station 11 on Netflix. I remember watching and it's post-apocalyptic kind of thing. Well, there's this one scene where this guy starts like making this beat and all of a sudden he starts rapping this Excursions by Tribe Called Quest. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, it's sit up. Right? Right?
Just worked it into the show. Like, okay.
And I remember the disc, that seat, and not the disc, but the tape that was worn out in my tape deck from listening to it in college. And I was just, it literally immediately brought me back. And mm-hmm. for a minute, like, I didn't see the actor. I just saw I saw memories. And it's mm-hmm. just bizarre how, but even that, like, is it the purpose, like connecting ourselves with ourselves again? I don't know.
I think there's multiple purposes.
Yeah. And I know you've talked about in the past, this is kind of talking about the nostalgia and memory in music, right?
Yes.
And it's like interesting how that, you know, and I'm sure you guys could tell me more about this, but you know, like music with memory and, you know, a lot of, in a medical context, you know, music therapy and stuff, it's like music has appeared to be this crazy tool healing that connects all these neurological pathways, right? So it's like mm-hmm. in Alzheimer's patients and 100%. All these different things, we've seen it do crazy things. So there is this, you know, that's almost the scientific side where it's like, okay, it's music is making these deeper connections in our brain, right? And then, but a big thing with like the history of music or nostalgia, because we've talked about the nostalgia music, how they like this show effectively used this song that's classic to us now, you know, in a way that is triggering a memory. It used it as a tool, right? Because music can have such a strong effect for, you know, some connection to us that they just used it as this tool, which is really cool.
It was to me, like, because I had even told him, I was like, this character, I really wasn't connected with this one particular character. And then he starts rapping this song that triggered something in me. And I was like, oh, he's now a cool character. Like it all
and because you like that music, it like made you feel a way about a character too.
Absolutely.
Which is a common thing in, you know, film scores, right? It's like characters will have themes. If you hear Darth Vader's theme, you go, oh no, I shouldn't like this person, right?
Don't want to like him. Yeah, right. Do not want to like him. That's so cool. Like I it sounds like, I mean, we have this question in here about your favorite genre. I don't know that you can have, can you have a favorite genre?
So I've thought about this.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, we talked about it, I saw that question. I'll have two answers. One is going to be yes, one is going to be no.
I love it.
I think, you know, why I like music is because of the diversity. And what I play, people ask me what genre even do I play. I'm just like, I don't know. Because that becomes boring to me if I had to do one thing.
Okay.
I think like why I love living in New Orleans, which I didn't expect a little bit, is how open it is to exploring whatever you want to do. You know, a little bit I thought, oh, I have to do very traditional New Orleans music, which I love and I'll grow from. But I mean, I started a bunch of weird bands here. I have a country band. I never thought I would be in a country band.
Okay.
I started like an experimental Ethiopian jazz band. That's
okay.
All these specific, you know, genres that I started exploring, I feel like New Orleans kind of allows welcomed you to it. Do that. Yeah,
yeah.
Which is really, really cool. And I really didn't expect that. So, you know, I think the diversity is what keeps music interesting to me and art, right? Is like,
yeah,
the fact that you can like so many things makes each one better because there's so much stuff. Then you can, I don't know, I think the diversity helps me appreciate it more.
So, yeah, how do you find time? I guess we saw you play, I guess, one of your
Carrollton
bands.
Station, yeah.
Carrollton Station, then at the Botanical Gardens. So do you have one consistent band that seems to tour or be more active?
No, it's a lot of different bands. You know, that's the big thing about coming here and playing the live music is that it is really hard to have one. You know, that's an ever-changing thing with the stability of making money from music is that really doing one project in a live music sense is not going to make a ton of money unless, you know, you're a band or an artist that's kind of getting bigger and you can go on national tours and stuff.
Sure.
And even that apparently is getting way harder for really, really big artists. That was a big thing with the Spotify rap thing that all these Outkast and people are like, we're not making money from this. And it's like, oh my God. Or, you know, it's like who is so, and then apparently touring where you would make the money from is not viable anymore. So some artists are saying like, oh, I know you really love this in Europe, but we just can't, or, you know, in a certain part of the States, but we can't go there or it's not worth it. So, I guess playing as many different things as I can, as long as there's an opportunity to play, I guess I have to do that. So that's part of it too. And luckily I just enjoy
it. But you do enjoy it. I was about to say, you do enjoy it. Yeah.
Especially when I try to keep it diverse. If it was, I was only playing in one type of band or group. I think it makes it beautiful because then I can, you know, my mind's kind of all over the place. So sometimes I could be studying country music or New Orleans jazz or second line drumming. And, you know, I can have like an outlet for that.
Sounds like you just jump in. Like you just as much as you say. To my detriment.
Yeah. Sometimes. Right.
As much as you say New Orleans welcomed you and take you, it's like you just throw yourself into these things as well.
And it is, you know, a big thing is I think I have to force myself into situations to really give myself the motivation to do something, but also learn from it. So a big thing was I could study New Orleans music elsewhere, but a big thing was I feel like since I've lived here, I may have picked up things that I don't think you can otherwise. I think that's the beautiful thing about culture here is that it's so small of a city, but the culture's so abundant that it's not, especially with music, it's almost like you just have to be around it for years to really start picking it up. You know, where it's not a thing where it's like marketed and stuff, which I think is really cool.
Yeah.
It's almost like you just have to be a part of the culture to really.
So if a local listener said, I want to go see Connor and see what he's up to, like, what does your calendar look like now?
Google calendar must be crazy.
It's a lot. Yeah. So I have to use Google calendar. That's how I keep all the gigs straight. I don't do a lot of regular things. I have a country band. We have a residency at Capulet in the Bywater. A lot of my residencies change, which is just like, you know, regular gig. So that's the thing is that the calendar is kind of always changing too.
Sure.
And what's the name of that band?
The Crescent City Gentlemen.
That's right. And do you still have the Ethiopian jazz band going?
Yeah. So we're kind of a band called Electric Baker.
Okay.
And we've, you know, we're always shifting our sound, but it was this band that used to play in Frenchman a lot. And our singer moved away to Austin. So the rest of us liked playing together and just wanted a way to stay together. So I kind of just found some music that I was really into. So like, maybe we could try this. And we just evolved to it's like instrumental, which I don't play in a lot of instrumental bands. And it's just kind of an outlet for whatever we're feeling. So we do weird movie covers. We've been starting to do video game music, but in like a jazz context. Yeah.
Anything you put out, original stuff on Spotify?
We have an EP coming out in the spring.
All right. Congratulations. Yeah. The Electric Baker. I love how that band name just come to be.
And so how do you find, you touched on Spotify, like putting out music now with the abundance and the world that's out there?
Yep.
Has that made it better or harder or different?
So I think an interesting thing is when I moved from Cleveland, when I lived in Cleveland, I'd play in a lot of indie bands. We worked at a music venue, a lot of my friends and I did, and we were kind of booking national indie bands and stuff. And we kind of saw we knew the industry and we really tried to make it in kind of two bands I was in to do the whole marketing thing, to try to get on record labels and all that stuff. And when I realized how different it is and how much it's changing and how hard that is, I kind of gave up that side of it. So since I've moved here, I've had a pretty different perspective on it. So most things I release is more just for my own sanity. It's like, I just like creating stuff and then there's an end and I just putting it out there is just almost like, okay, you've just made something, you know? So there's no real intention with it. A lot of it is put on streaming services, but you know that that's not going to generate any revenue or anything. So it's more just like having a place if somebody wants to listen to it. You could be like, oh, it's on Apple Music or whatever. Yeah.
We've talked to a few artists that I mean, obviously most artists probably feel that way. It's unfortunate and frustrating that you can have some industries that are so overwhelmingly compensated, but then, I mean, you're not just following a rule book or a playbook. I mean, no diss against athletes, but you're actually creating, you're coming together, you're putting in the work. Something has to turn. I feel hopeful.
Unfortunately, with the pandemic, it's actually how I got into teaching. was the beginning of the pandemic. Surprisingly, one-on-one instruction was one of the first things to come back. But within pandemic, I used to just, you know, play gigs and stuff before that. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we realized really quick with the essential workers, art is the least essential, quote unquote, job there is, right? Even though what everyone was doing when you're at home during the pandemic is you're watching Netflix and you're watching movies, you're listening content to podcasts, you know, it's all art, right? And that's what keeps us human, right?
Absolutely.
But it's like, unfortunately, it is the least funded part, right? So immediately it was like, okay, if things go bad, art is going to be the first thing in currently how, you know, I guess the system we're running off of it is
meeting your basic needs, right?
Yeah. And it's just, it's the first thing to go. So it made me realize, ooh, I kind of have to look out for myself more because art is not a sustainable thing in a certain
society.
Always necessarily. Always. Yeah. Right. There's situations that come up like the pandemic. Horrific.
Well, we feel it. I mean, speaking of live concerts, I mean, like we travel all the time to see artists and I mean, it's just part of being human, mm-hmm. like, you know,
and it's different for different people. So some people may not appreciate the music aspect as much as we do, but that is something that we appreciate and we try to promote for others to maybe who do get it and others that might want to try it out and buy in.
Yeah. You I never mean, know. If only people were like you guys, you know, it's like art would be more supported. Right. But yeah, but the crazy part, it's not like all these people are not partaking in art. They are, they just don't have that same, you know, they're just not supporting it in the same way. It's okay. I get it. You know, everyone has to look out for themselves. It's not really, I don't think because of all these individuals, I think it's because of larger systems at play.
Right.
You know, music venues, the music industry, just art, you know, how art is funded in schools and art programs and stuff like that.
I we've talked about that as well. Like that needs to come back. Like seeing the energy, the activity, the youth, at, you know, School of Rock. I mean, and I'm sure there's many other places like that as well. Like you just see the bright part of children that is alive, and you all tap into that. And you've even said yourself, like the concert coming up, the winter concert in January, you shared is inspired by Talking Heads.
We're actually performing David Byrne, the Talking Heads, Stop Making Sense. So cool. In its entirety, having a bunch of kids.
Now, had they heard any of this before?
About half of them.
Okay.
So, yeah. A lot of the kids we teach at the school in our performance program, like in my group, range from about elementary school to high school. And, you know, they all sign up for different groups. We have shows based on different stuff. And mine was, of course, David Byrne. Stop Making Sense, the live album by the Talking Heads, or the live concert documentary, which this year was the 40th year anniversary of it.
So cool.
It was re-released in theaters. So it's a very, you know, and when I saw it, it kind of changed me too, because I realized that the depth that David Byrne has is that not only is this like a something about this is a little bit extra musical. It's like there's this performance element. There's this extra art to it. And it was a little bit deeper. So, you know, we've been for the past 5 or 6 months now, like working on recreating the album. And these kids are doing the entire concert song for song in its entirety. They sound pretty good if I do say so.
And that is fun. When is that show?
That's 14? January 13th at Zony Mesh. Yeah.
Got it. I think I just saw it on the calendar.
I did.
So.
Absolutely. Put it on there. Because then it seems like when you see things through, like for instance, just this weekend we were putting up the Christmas tree and we were playing Christmas music and then Gabriel deviated to, I don't know, Depeche Mode or something. And I'm looking at this 12-year-old like, that's cool, but it's not Christmas music. But that's cool because you rediscover it in a new, I know you do, you rediscover it every time. He never played the typical songs for the kids in the car. It was always like, Alt Nation or something are the classics, right?
Sure. What I consider, right? Yeah. So they kind of adopted it and it's interesting.
But this connection with nostalgia and emotions, and you touched on, the medical aspect of, yes, there is, you know, music therapy and we've seen it heal everything from the ICU to, as you mentioned, dementia and whatnot. But is there some more science that maybe people aren't even understanding? Because I hear people say, well, what is this about the, you know, the Taylor Swift effect or the Beyonce effect? And yes, they are tremendous performers in their own right. But are they connecting on some almost like cellular level?
I think those are the Beyonce's and Taylor Swift are the most interesting, because it's like you almost want there to be a scientific answer, right? It's just like, you know, or like the Beatles when they first came out, right? It's just like a phenomenon. It's like, what about what they're doing? I mean, it's good music and it's pop. And go back to the answer, favorite genre, I do have one. It's experimental pop. I'm just going to generally label that, which I think, you know, Beyonce definitely and arguably Taylor Swift might fall into, which is almost progressive pop music, that like music, which I think has a little bit to do with memory nostalgia, where pop is almost this immediate, there's something about it. Pop music is so structured. It's almost scientific, right? It's like, they're writing these songs that are the same thing. First chorus, bridge, first chorus. But we love it. Like, I love it.
Yeah.
We all love it. There's something, I think it's just like scientific about it.
Yeah.
And Taylor Swift can keep doing that with the same four chords and yet make new things. That's crazy. And we, something about it, we're like, yes, give us more. But I think they have a little bit more, especially I've seen Beyonce, you know, kind of push the boundaries in music where it's almost, it's pop music. So you can sing along to it. It's catchy. It's getting stuck in your head, but something about it is a little bit progressive and, you know, kind of like new art that they're kind of moving it forward. So, you know, all of my favorite artists, I feel like could, and this could be anyone from Beyonce to the Beatles to Kendrick Lamar to Michael Jackson, which is like music that's resonating with a lot of people, but for some reason it's a little bit more. It's, you know, maybe for certain, theoretical reasons, like more advanced or something, or it's pushing the boundaries in a new way, or they're trying new textures or forms or, you know, different things in their music, techniques and stuff like that.
You know, it's
integrating new things. Yeah.
It's funny you say that, because just in the car this past weekend, my mom, who's 80, was driving around with us and we're like, hey, listen to one of Gabriel's favorite new artists, NF. So it's a rap, and she's listening to it. It's like, oh, wow. None of the verses repeat. So I was like, that's interesting. I guess I never tell you.
We never would have thought about that, right? Yeah. Part.
So is it just the melodies? I guess rap is a little different, right?
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's like rap is such an interesting thing, because all of a sudden it was like, you're right. It's so much emphasis is now in the verse, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where before it was like, that was the forgettable part. And yeah, it's like, I haven't really thought about that, but now we're kind of thinking about it. That's cool, right? It's like, oh, wow.
It's so much emphasis played out with music.
That's almost the most important part,
yeah.
And then the hook is just the part that we're all going to love, right?
Right.
But it's almost like, now there's more emphasis on the verse, which is just like a new
formula.
Yeah, or like a new evolution of it, yeah. Right.
That's exactly. So funny. That I didn't even.
And you can almost think about hip-hop in general, because it's, well, now it's always changing, but for a long time, like the dominant popular music of the world, right? It's like, it was almost like pop music, but it just had these new elements. So it's kind of like experimental pop, right?
Right.
It kind of went back to the short song forms, and there's still hooks and stuff, but you're right. There's new elements about it that made it cutting edge.
Right.
Yeah.
And then because of that, it also changes like if you ask some people purpose of music, some people, if you're a dancer, they say it's to move, to dance. But there's some songs that you just love and music you love, you can't really dance to it. I mean, you can try, or you can move, bump your hip. But like, you know, like a lot, I feel like a lot of the older maybe music was set so that you can do a certain type of dance. I don't know.
Even David Byrne talks about that in the book, about how the context of the music shaped the music. So jazz comes out of, in dance halls, people would be dancing to it, and so they wouldn't stop to extend it. Essentially, improvisation was kind of formed from that. So they would have longer song forms, and then the musicians would just solo over it. And then jazz comes out of that, you know, and then it becomes just a whole new thing. So it's like the context that it was dancing music led to the evolution of the music. It's like really his whole big thesis is like, it all has to do with like the environment. You know, another big thing, talking about hip hop, he talks about, like, David Byrne loves hip hop, and he's talking about how it's this genre of music that was made for cars. It was like at the height of like when CDs were coming out, and you can have these new bass, you know, like
12-inch amps.
You can have these really like loud subwoofers and stuff, and the bass is almost way more powerful than metal records in the 80s. It's like this whole new world, right? And then he said it's sharing music. You can listen to your car and other people are listening to it. And he's like, thank you for that.
Whole neighborhood.
I love what a perspective of like an older guy is like, thank you for sharing your hip hop. I'm like, you're so different than other people. I love that.
Right.
He's very special.
But yeah, you know, then he was saying like hip hop, because of the context in which it was listened to, it's mixed to be a certain way. It's like the bass is really low. You need like a really loud drum beat. And then like there's not a lot of middle range sound. So you can hear the hooks and the rapping and all that stuff. So it's, it, wow. You know, it's like evolved out of the context in which it was being listened to and stuff.
Yeah.
Think about that. That is so cool. That is
so, so when
cool.
Do you find time to actually write or
compose? Yeah.
It's hard. It's hard. Because, you know, a lot of the time spent practicing or learning songs and stuff. So I can't say that I have a set schedule, mm-hmm. which is actually, you know, talking about people being struck by inspiration and stuff. A lot of the best songwriters and my personal favorite songwriter, Jeff Tweedy, okay. from the band Wilco. He's written a few books. He wrote an autobiography recently, and he's very earnest about the process of songwriting and how it's almost the more scientific side where we think these artists are tapping into something, and they totally are, but mm-hmm. people don't understand the work ethic with stuff. Like, you know, it's not like every mm-hmm. song Bob Dylan or Beyonce or Taylor Swift ever wrote just came to them and that, you know, they're walking. Sure. It's like they had to sit there for hours, and you know, they probably set aside time to write music, and yeah. that's what he talks about, is like, you know, set aside this time and work. And it's like the same thing with Stephen King, how Stephen King said he's a terrible writer. He's like, I'm the least motivated thing. And he talks about how every day he has to set aside time or he would never write a book in his life. So wow. it's not like, you know, and we think of that as like, oh, that's the most popular writer there is. Right.
Very
and
prolific,
he's talked about there. That a lot where he's like, I have to do this. Otherwise nothing will come. Wow. So I think that's what's really interesting is like, sometimes there's a mystery with music too, where it's like, how are they making this great art? And I think a lot of it, and what he's getting at, is that you have to be a hard worker.
Yeah.
And they're all hard workers. It's not like it just came to them. And it does sometimes, you know. We are tapping into a bunch of things. We're tapping into the history of music that came before us, of music right. that's popular, of what we think is going to do well. But also there's that extra thing that we don't really know. You know, that's the magical part of music, mm-hmm. that it's like, why did we actually end up with this specific one? But to get that, a lot of them talk about how you need to have that time, you know, right. to do it, or nothing's really going to happen. So personally, I do need to be better about, you know, setting aside that time, but
I mean, so in a way it is work, but not in a like, oh, it's work. Like, you know, we talk about that old saying, you know, what's the opposite of play? What would you say?
Well, it depends.
I like that. Of course, you.
I guess work.
Right. But, most people would say work.
But
right?
if you love your work.
But if you love your work. But research has shown that the opposite of play is actually death. Right. So, I mean.
Yeah. No, we got to try to keep moving, find purpose,
absolutely.
And things to stay busy and hopefully do good
mm-hmm.
and do good. And continue to spread. Because it's different strokes for different folks. But we value this so much.
Yeah, and I can't say it enough. Thank you for taking your time to be here. But I do have one more, maybe one and a half more question.
Yeah, absolutely.
So because, you know, we like to travel, we like history, we like, you know, museums, if you will. But you've also shared something that you've kind of picked up, and again, the way you so eloquently describe it, but in your travels from New Orleans to Cleveland, you've picked up something along the way as far as, which I've never visited, an old school, if you will, recording studio. Even when we were in mm-hmm. Nashville, I think it's on our bucket list. But what can you put into your...
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a bunch. This is really good because there's a lot with this. Because I'm originally from Cleveland, driving down to New Orleans, quite a far drive across the country, which is through the middle of the country, Kentucky and stuff. In my mind, I'm like, oh, this is the most boring part of the country, right? Like nothing here.
Okay.
Like there's, you know, there's Nashville, right? But I'm like, there's nothing along the way. Yeah, it's just like that stuff. St. Louis a little odd, you know, it's like,
sure.
I like that to Chicago.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm kind of thinking like all these states, there's not a lot here. And then it wasn't until about 4 years ago that I really got into traditional country music and the history of Ken Burns put out that country Western documentary and that.
I haven't seen
it. Oh, it's changed my, it was awesome. I literally started a country band because of it. It's awesome. And he makes you love like anything in history. And, you know, I started getting into that. I had been to Nashville 8 to 10 times. I thought about moving there. I know it was a cool music city, but it wasn't until I got, you know, into the history of country that I went there. I went to the Country Music Hall of Fame, which is fantastic. I think it's better than the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Okay.
Even as like a surface level country fan. And took a tour of RCA Studio B, which is like the recording studio in Nashville where Jolene was recorded at. Elvis did most of his recordings. Wow. Fats Domino recorded a lot. All these different people. And I realized just like the magic of being this empty, you know, or like a room like this where you're like, okay, it's a room and there's stuff in here. But then you realize like all the beautiful things. I mean, just kind of like sound, this room, like you guys have a lot of people in here. Sure. You've had memories, you play music in here. And then it's like, it's a room, but there's like more to it because of that, the ephemeral stuff that happens in there. Right. Mm-hmm. But then, so getting into the history of recorded music, which has always been my favorite, like studio bands and, you know, really the 60s and the early 70s is like the height of recorded music. That's when it was the most money was being pumped into it and they were trying to get the most people through. Then it was sort of on a decline as far as like live musicians or like getting bands, you know, because people had cut corners. Then you have just artists, then you have producers, and slowly the people started fading out. But getting into the history of that, I kind of realized, oh, most of recorded music is Memphis, Alabama, and Muscle Shoals, Nashville, so cool. Memphis, mm-hmm. And then, you know, the history of blues and stuff in Mississippi. And I started connecting and be like, wait, actually the route I take might be the most important musical route in the country. So cool. And it kind of, you know, I start by driving up the blues highway in Mississippi.
Okay.
And then eventually get to Memphis. And I'm like, wait, this is actually when that kind of clicked, I was like, oh, this is, I've got to drive this all the time and, you know, see as much as I can. And that really got me into the history of it. And then when I was in Memphis during Ida, we ended up going to Memphis and I was at Stax Studio, which is like the big studio, Booker T and the MGs, and where all the soul came from, like Otis Redding formed there, Memphis. Staple singers and stuff. Yeah.
Wow.
So I got a book there called The Country Soul Triangle. And it talks about the history of soul music and country music, especially in like the 50s and 60s and early 70s, how that was like some of the most popular recorded music. But it talks about the history of how country music began to be labeled politically as white music and soul music as black music. Mm-hmm. The whole book mm-hmm. is about how, well, it's actually all the same people playing it. And it's all coming from the same regions. And it's only because of like exterior Amazing. Reasons that people are like trying to separate it. And it's like, it kind of talked about the history of all of this is like happening together in this big, like melting pot. Wow. And it's like, oh, this is beautiful. You know, that's really, really cool.
Cause you're right. You do think of it as two separate, things. It's two separate, you know, pools of interest, if you will. But it, yeah.
Connor, I think you need a class.
Okay. I'm going to put it out there. Yeah. Teaching. I think you need to teach a class. You need to have a podcast. And if anyone's out there, I think you need a show like where they send you to all these places and you get
there. I like taking classes because I like, you know, learning as much as I can. I just find it fascinating and stuff. I mean, but talking to people, I think, is like a good way to
disseminate knowledge. It's easy to learn. Yeah. Is it not? It's amazing. Yeah. It's
there's so much
easy to
learn.
You
just rattled off some stuff. I'm like, man, I could spend hours just trying to learn
yes
more.
Honestly, like, what's the guy who had the eating food show all over the world? Like, you should do that. Like, you should go, because you really, really, you're it's like you want to be a conduit to all this amazing knowledge, not just hold on.
Yeah, and I mean, I would, if anyone's listening wants to support me being the Anthony Bourdain of the
that's it I couldn't remember his name. Seriously, do we know some people? Absolutely. I mean, 100%, because that's what it's about. Kind of like with music, like you want to be that conduit that it passes through you and you share it and you give it off.
He did kind of tap into, you know, it wasn't he was almost like a cultural bearer because he hangs out with musicians and talks to like local people, and then food was just like one way in or conduit into like
an
more
aspect of it.
That's a beautiful way of putting it. I know you didn't bring an instrument, but maybe our next interview when you have your show.
Yeah.
I'm putting it out there. I'm just going to put it. Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is amazing. And so can you want to kind of send a shout out or give us some where we can see you in the very near future?
I'm playing this Friday. I don't know if that's too soon.
That's okay. Yeah.
Okay. It's so this Friday, hopefully if all things go to plan, it's my friend Derek, who you guys have seen before.
Yes.
It's his debut album release.
He did say that. Yes.
He also booked the bill that I'm playing in three of the bands. So you can see three of the bands I'm playing with there.
Okay.
Which is also Dusky Waters, my friend Jen. She's a Americana singer-songwriter who you guys have seen before.
Yeah. Yes. Beautiful.
And then Tiny Dinosaur, who is another band her and I are in. It's similar, a little bit weirder folk, but it's still in the same world. Yes. So, you know, this is almost three outlets of the same world.
Wow.
And then we're actually, Derek's having the house band, the School of Rock house band, which he directs. So a lot of the kids from the school are playing there too,
fun.
Which will
Look
be cool.
That.
Yeah.
Exciting. Well, I thank you for everything that you continue to do for so many and inspiration. And
yes.
Yeah.
Connor McCreary, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, Connor, so awesome. Thank you.
We appreciate you.
Cool.
Special thanks to our producer, John Gerard.
And our coordinating manager, Olivia Olson.
Be sure to follow us on Instagram @MixtapeHopePodcast.
Thank you.